All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, I am here by myself again. Alan, where in God's name are you?
I am at the Pontchartrain Yacht Club, where the Battle of Lake Pontchartrain took place September 10, 1779. Revolutionary War battle, I might add.
Oh, well, very interesting. Well,
yeah, we got boats passing by. It's pretty cool. Man, much better than where you are.
No, man. You can't get better than where I am. The typical in the office, away from the sun because the sun's a monster. All right.
Hey, you know, Laura and I, we went into the yacht club and we pretended like we were members as we used the facilities there.
Nice.
See the boat.
Hey, what's up, everyone? I'm Dustin Bass. Welcome to the Sons of History. Doctor?
Doctor? I'm Alan Joaquim. I'm out here at on location of where the Battle of Lake Pontchartrain took place, outside the Pontchartrain Yacht Club on the north shore of Lake Pontchartrain.
All right, so tell everybody exactly what you are doing out there.
Well, I'm doing a video series on the Gulf Coast campaign conducted by Spanish Governor Bernardo de Galvez, which greatly aided George Washington and the Continental Army because the British were forced to redeploy thousands of soldiers from New York City into places such as here and in the Caribbean. So a lot of battles took place here during the Revolutionary War, and one of them was the Battle of Lake Pontchartrain, which occurred right behind me. And then the area itself was declared no longer part of the British sphere of influence. So I will get into that later on in my little video. But this is just one of many places that we're going.
So the battle took place in that little gazebo. That's amazing. Weren't you thinking of having someone come with you? They were going to dress up like Bernardo de Galvez. They were going to...
we're thinking about... you're thinking of Michael Christian, right? I didn't have a chance to ask him. I had a choice between Michael Christian and my girlfriend. And I think my girlfriend kind of wins out. So, and she's been kind enough to, record. She's my videographer. That's the correct way to say it. She's doing a much better job than my tripod ever did. So, plus she, yes, right. And she fixes my hair too when it's messed up, which is quite frequently.
Well,
or my collars, but you know.
Yeah, then we.
Makeup. You know, if my makeup is smeared everywhere. Joking about the makeup. I don't wear makeup, at least not in public. Anyway, so yeah, that's what we're doing.
Well, your lips look really pink, and maybe we should have her come out all the time to make sure your hair is as it should be for every episode.
Well, yeah, she was the best studio audience we ever had.
Yes, indeed. Well, dude, I hope that you and Laura have fun, get some great videos. I hope you get that drone to work out. I had a feeling that you were going to get out there. And it was going to require you getting up on a tree. Hey, relax.
Hey, have you no faith in me?
Zero. When it comes to technology, zero faith.
Hey, I'm in the IT field.
You work in IT.
The drone has been a little bit complicated, but I will have it set up and ready to go before we reach New Orleans. So.
All right. Well, I got $10 says you won't.
Hey, listen, Dustin, we're kind of losing a little bit of light. I got some, I got videos to do, places to go, people to see, that kind of stuff. So losing the sunlight. So let's get into this week in history. So I am going to go with May the 10th, but on two different years. 1775 is the first one. Now, two events happened on that day. Ethan Allen and Benedict Arnold captured Fort Ticonderoga. At the same time, in Philadelphia, the Second Continental Congress opened its session, and a very effective one, I might add. George Washington was a member. Thomas Jefferson eventually showed up. You had John Adams. You had the works there, the first three presidents. And They opened in Philadelphia because their demands for the First Continental Congress was not met, and so they were going to meet anyway. It was just a coincidence that they happened to meet the same day as the capture of Fort Ticonderoga. So that happened in 1775. The other one is in 1940. There were three events that happened, and they're all related. Winston Churchill became the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, took over for Neville Chamberlain, who was considered an utter failure. Britain also invaded Iceland. Yes, it wasn't like they were friends, NATO. They just took it over because they were afraid that the Germans were going to invade and capture Iceland, which is kind of what they did with Norway and Denmark. But at the same time, on May the 10th, the Germans launched an attack into Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg. Now, they were doing, kind of a Schlieffen plan. The Germans were going to go through those countries and then go into France from the north, bypassing the Maginot Line, which was the defensive fortifications between the German and French border. But the British and the French knew this, so they figured, okay, if the Germans come in, we're going to attack and try to stop them at the border, and hopefully they won't ever even get into France. But see, the Germans, they like to play chess, I'm assuming, because they thought two, three steps ahead. They figured the British and French were going to do that, so they waited a couple of days, and as soon as the British and French armies were bunched up, they attacked and just, they invaded all the way into the French coast, literally trapping the Belgian, French, and British armies. And they had to evacuate through Dunkirk. So that all began May the 10th of 1940. So those are my two days, or my two dates for the same date on the calendar, but in different years.
Interesting that you would choose May 10th, because I also am choosing May 10th, but a different year. Pretty much smack dab in the middle of your two selections. Mine is May 10th, 1849. This is the Astor Place Riot. The Astor Place was an opera house in New York City. And what had happened were there were two actors, one British actor, his name was William Charles MacReady or MacReady, and an American actor by the name of Edwin Forrest. And it's very interesting that these two guys, they were more or less Shakespearean actors, but the guy from America was more of your supported by sort of the lower class. The MacReady guy from Britain, he was supported by the upper class. Well, they started following each other, sort of trying to compete with each other, even in Britain and in America. And so you had sort of almost like a class warfare through the idea of acting and Shakespearean acting. So MacReady comes to New York City and he's going to perform as King Macbeth in the Shakespearean play Macbeth. Well, Forrest, he's like, okay, I'm going to act at the same time in another place. Well, the lower class in New York City, they weren't really big fans of MacReady. The upper class really were. So MacReady, he starts performing, and guess what? Some of the lower class people had bought tickets, got in, started throwing eggs at him and booing him and hissing him, so they had to shut down the whole thing. Well, the upper class people were like, hey, come on back. We'll make sure that nothing happens tomorrow night, which tomorrow night would have been May 10th, 1849. Well, the lower class people, I say upper class, lower class, because that's what it was. They start trying to get into the opera house, but the militia, the 7th Regiment militia, shows up and they are going to keep everybody out of the opera house. While they try to get in, they start throwing stones at the militia members. What happens? The militia fires into the crowd. More than 20 people are killed. A lot more are injured. Major riot takes place. MacReady or MacReady, he escapes because he thinks they're going to come and get him and kill him. He escapes to Boston, goes back to Britain, never to return again. But interestingly enough, riots didn't take place again in New York. Everybody was afraid that, man, some major riots are about to take place, but no riot took place again until 1863, when you had the draft more or less take place for the Civil War. So that is my selection of This Week in History. Alan, so glad that you could join me on your tour of the lower states in the American Revolutionary War. I'm looking forward to what you put together, especially the Battle of New Orleans. That's going to be cool stuff.
Well, hopefully we'll have the drone working by then. And then, yes, we'll be at that battlefield. And then, you know, we did go to Natchez, a couple places in and around Baton Rouge. So that'll be our next stop. So we're looking forward to it, and we'll get it out soon, or as soon as we can, I should say.
All right, man. Well, it's good to see you and your Ray-Bans. You look really cool. So
you're going to go in style, right?
Amen. All right. Well, that's This Week in History. Well, that was pretty interesting. It's always nice to have Alan on the Zoom call rather than here in real life. Such a delight. An absolute delight. All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, speaking of delights, we've got our guest lined up, Dr. Olivier Zuns. He is the James Madison Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Virginia. He recently retired. He taught at the University of Virginia for more than 40 years. Very excited to have him. Here are some of the works that he has put together. He has written The Changing Face of Inequality, Urbanization, Industrial Development, and Immigrants in Detroit, 1880 to 1920. Making America Corporate, 1870 to 1920. Why the American Century, Philanthropy in America, A History, and the latest one, The Man Who Understood Democracy, The Life of Alexis de Tocqueville, a biography on more or less the political philosophies of Alexis de Tocqueville, but it does discuss in slight detail his life, but it primarily focuses on his thoughts on democracy. I cannot encourage you enough to buy this book. I recently read it, did a review on it for the Epoch Times. If you haven't checked that out, then definitely check out the book. Here's a few more things that he has worked on as far as editing goes. He's edited a number of works on Tocqueville, including the great work, Democracy in America, the work that Alexis de Tocqueville put together when he came over here in the 1830s and wrote his multi-volume work, Democracy in America. His editing was for the Arthur Goldhammer translation. So, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, I am delighted and honored to have Dr. Zuns on the line. Dr. Zuns, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, it is an absolute honor to have you on. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Alexis de Tocqueville, it's, you know, as a Frenchman, he has such, even today, almost 200 years after his death, he has such an impact on Americans and the way Americans think about their very own country. And I thoroughly enjoyed your book, The Man Who Understood Democracy, and I can't wait to jump right into the conversation. Now, my first question is, so Tocqueville was born at the beginning of Napoleon's reign as Emperor of France, but how did the French Revolution, and in particular the Reign of Terror, impact him and help formulate his political philosophies?
Tocqueville was the scion of the highest ranks of French nobility. French nobility is usually, is divided into two parts. One is called the old nobility of Sword, as it is called, basically the military nobility. And then people who were in the nobility because of their ranks in the royal administration. On his father's side, Tocqueville was a scion of the nobility of Sword, the highest ranks of the military nobility. On his mother's side, his great-grandfather was director of the book trade under Louis XV, actually protected the philosopher in the 18th century from censorship, had been the lawyer, the king's lawyer during the king's trial, during the terror. many family members were decimated by the terror in 1793-94. His great-grandfather, Malesherbes, was guillotined. His grandparents were guillotined. An uncle and an aunt, a number of cousins. His parents barely escaped. They were in prison waiting for their turn when the Robespierre regime fell and the slaughter stopped. This family paid a heavy price for its membership in the highest ranks of nobility. Tocqueville's family remained loyal despite the revolution and despite the coming of Napoleon. The Tocqueville's family remained loyal to the old royal family, to the Bourbons, and they were therefore so-called legitimist, and for the legitimate holders of the French royalty of the throne. And Tocqueville remained a legitimist throughout his childhood and early adulthood, and was still very much in favor of the old monarchy before traveling to America. But he traveled to America at age 25. So he was a young man. This being said, he was the only one in his family and among their friends and larger network to make the shift, to actually embrace democracy. He did it. The trip to America was a big part of it. Writing Democracy in America was an equally big part of it, because the trip itself was not enough. The reflection upon the trip and the writing of the book made a big difference. You know, writing is always a form of learning. And so he was deeply affected by the events that preceded his birth.
Was there a sense of, you said he was the only one in his family who made the shift, sort of towards the political philosophy of that which, as you said, decimated his family? Was there a sense of betrayal viewed from his family towards Alexis de Tocqueville, that he's embracing this political viewpoint that sort of encompassed the Reign of Terror?
Well, it's a very good question. Because the fact that Tocqueville, there are two parts answer. The fact that Tocqueville embraced democracy doesn't mean he embraced the terror, quite the contrary. So his vision of democracy did not include that episode or the philosophy supporting it. But Tocqueville was a very affectionate person. He was shy and somewhat diffident, but he had a great gift for friendship and loyalty to family and friends. He was a man of deep intelligence, as we all know, and he knew how to maintain a relationship with people he strongly disagreed with. It was not always the case. There were some moments where he broke off, especially with one of his brothers, at times, and then reconciled, depending on the circumstances. But by and large, Tocqueville was very, had the gift of conversation. He was very open in conversation, had the gift of loyalty to family and friends, and was himself sufficiently ambiguous in his feelings towards democracy. He used to describe himself as aristocratic by instinct and democratic by reason. He was an aristocrat by instincts and a democrat by reason. And I think he lived it that way.
So you mentioned from America's perspective, the most famous thing that Alexis de Tocqueville did was write democracy in America. He's known for coming over here, like you said, at the age of 25, around 1830, he comes over with his friend and Beaumont, and they're here to study the American prison system. So why was he over here studying the American prison system, and what did he learn from that?
Well, okay. So, yes, he was here to study the American prison system, the penitentiary reforms. He always said it was a pretext to visit America. It was a good pretext, but how did that come about? After law school, during the French Restoration of the monarchy in the 1820s, Tocqueville's father was a civil servant, a prefect, royal prefect in the royal administration, found a job for his son at a courthouse in Versailles as an apprentice prosecutor. Tocqueville was not very successful in that job. He was never a good public speaker, which actually was a real problem during his entire life because he had the ambition to be a politician. And, you know, long before the technology of amplification, you needed to have a voice that carried and a lot of punch to speak publicly. Tocqueville never had it. So his speeches were always better read than listened to. This being said, he was not a very successful in his early career as an apprentice prosecutor, even though he was serious about it and people recognized his intelligence. He was not sure that he could accept the revolution of 1830, which brought with it constitutional monarchy in France, because he was still loyal to the absolute monarchy of the old royal family. And the junior branch of the royal family, the Orléans, had replaced the Bourbons and had agreed to a constitutional monarchy after the revolution of 1830. Tocqueville was unsure he could support that regime, although he swore an oath of loyalty to it. Just his family advised him to do so, just to make sure he could have a career, a job. But he decided it was time to sort of do something else. He didn't really know what to do something else. He had studied history with François Guizot, who was a great historian early in the 20th century, followed his lectures. Guizot was a great admirer of the British constitutional system and French liberals of the day. We're studying England as a possibility for the French constitutional monarchy, 1830 being kind of a French glorious revolution of 1688, so to speak. Tocqueville decided that he wasn't going to go to England, he was going to go to America to see what a real democracy was like, and to see whether he could ever live in one, if it were to come. But he needed to have the means to do so. And penitentiary reform was in the air. There had been a prison reform society that had been created a few years before in France. A number of reformers had written books on this. Nobody had actually gone to see American prisons. Everything that was known about the penitentiary reform in Sing Sing or Auburn or Philadelphia, Eastern State, was from secondary sources, so from hearsay, from reporting, but not from direct observation. So Tocqueville and his friend at the courthouse, Beaumont, another young man he had been befriended there, put together a proposal to the Minister of Justice. It was actually the perfect grant proposal. I don't know how often you write grant proposals, but it's a model for one. I don't know whether the NSF would take it today, or the NIH, or the NEH, but it was a perfect proposal. And explaining why it was important to see American prisons, to observe them, to at some point, you know, because you think prison Stouffville would say, well, you know, we live like the prisoner, except for being whipped and locked in the cell. So they spent time there, interviewed prisoners. So it was a serious job, and they got the assignment. So they got a leave of absence from, they didn't have to resign their position. They both got a leave of absence from the courthouse and went to America to write this report. But Stouffville always said it was a pretext. It was just a way to actually see a democracy at work.
So he uses that as a pretext to run about the states in America, meet a ton of people. In your book, you mention a whole lot of people that he runs into and who influence him. Through that influence, through that experience, he writes Democracy in America, 4 volumes. What did each of those volumes accomplish? And secondly, if anything, what did he get wrong about America?
Okay, so this is a simple question that will have a complicated answer. I'm going to try to make it as simple as I can. Before Tocqueville left France, before he came here in 1831, again, as a young aristocrat raised in this circle of legitimists, most of them having rejected not only the revolution, but the Napoleonic Empire, although some had served Napoleon. Most of them having regained their position of power during the restoration of the French monarchy after the collapse of the Napoleonic Empire. For these people in this circle of legitimists, as we call them, equality was the worst thing they could think of. Equality was leveling. It was the idea of taking away their privilege, taking away their prerogatives. It was a bad word, okay? What Tocqueville discovered in America was a really kind of a big hit, a big revelation, is that equality for the white population, and I insist on this, not because I have to today, but because Tocqueville was a lifelong abolitionist, and from a young age all the way to the end, and worked extensively for the abolition of slavery in the French colonies. Tocqueville realized that for the white population, equality could be the source of liberty. That equality would give more and more people, a greater number of people, a chance to achieve their goals, to realize their life, and therefore equality, instead of meaning leveling and meant uplifting. So that is in a nutshell the great conceptual transformation that Tocqueville owes to his American trip. Okay. And we can go back to that later on the relationship between equality and liberty if you want to. But to rephrase quickly the second part of your question, and correct me if I'm wrong, so what did he get in America? Well,
what did he get wrong about America? Yeah.
Well, okay. He got a lot of things right and he got a lot of things wrong. Or to put it more simply, he got a lot of things right and he missed a lot of things. It's not so much that he got things wrong, that as that he got a lot of things right, he missed a lot of things. That is perfectly to be understood. He was a young man, 25 years old. He knew virtually nothing about the country before coming. He learned English on the boat. And after 9.5 months here and 3 months at home going over his notes and writing, he wrote a book that changed the ways in which Americans and the rest of the world think about society and civil society and politics. So it's not a bad achievement. Now, the reason why he did this is because, okay, what he saw was extremely important, and what he understood was extremely important. What he missed was sometimes quite surprising, and we can talk about it in a second. But the larger story is that democracy in America is only partly, and perhaps not for the most part, but only partly a book of observation. It's not a travelogue. It's a book of reflection. It's largely a book of invention of a political theory. So much of it is based on observation, especially the first volume. You know, he wrote it in two installments. One he published in 1835, and the second he published in 1840, 5 years later. So the first volume is much closer to America than the second. The second tends to be a general theory of democracy. John Stuart Mill was a great aristocratic liberal of England at the time and a friend of Tocqueville, made very keen observations on the significance of that general theory. But the first book is closer to the trip. And the second is further away, but even in the second is further away.
So I wanna pull a quote from your book, because it is this contrast. It's this guy, this Frenchman who comes over to America, as you said, and I think this is a testament further to his brilliance that he learns English on the way over to America. Is you have this contrast of France and America, a brand new country compared to a country that's been around for so long, well-established, has gone through, obviously, a major revolution, as did we, because we, you know, garnered much of what we were from the British, but we still had a revolution, but very different outcomes. So the quote is, "He was impressed by the power of judicial review in America, living in a time when no French court could dream of invalidating a law by deeming it unconstitutional. As for American officials who abused their position, they were subject to scrutiny and could be removed by impeachment." So, how different was America compared to post-Napoleon France? And how did Tocqueville try to convince the French to be more like America?
Okay, I'm going to answer this, of course. I realize that I didn't fully answer your question on, not even really begin to answer your question on what he saw well and what he missed. And I think you will want to return to that, because I think that's important. I didn't mean to escape it. This is really a key here. That is to say, the division of power, the separation of power, is something that was critical in convincing Tocqueville that it had to be an essential part of democracy. The French tradition, after centuries of absolutism in the monarchy, was absolute power. Once you have power, you control it. You don't. You know, there is no separation of powers. The revolutionaries who abolished the monarchy seized power and applied the same principle. The revolution was fought, Tocqueville argued quite a bit in his last book on the French old regime. The revolution was fought in the name of liberty, but it ended up in a new despotism, hence the Napoleonic regime. So what Tocqueville really thought of the tragedy of French history was this idea that every reform movement fought in the name of liberty ended up in a form of despotism. It was kind of a French malady. And he lived through it. He lived through it himself in the there had been in his childhood, the Napoleonic Empire had taken over from the revolution. Then when the empire collapsed and the absolute monarchy came back, then the revolution of 1848 abolished the constitutional monarchy that because of its own abuses, but only to collapse itself again in the return of the empire with the second Napoleon following in the footsteps of the uncle, the nephew, following in the footsteps of the uncle and creating the second empire. So Tocqueville really was proven right time and again that it was kind of a French malady. And on the other hand, America had shown an example of that the only way to maintain liberty was in partly to restrict it, and to restrict it through the separation of powers. Now, maybe if you can ask me again, I'm sorry, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but about what he missed and what he didn't miss, I can actually answer that.
Well, I mean, are you saying that that's sort of what he missed was understanding that the source of liberty was the restriction of liberty, or at least the restriction of power by those?
No, he understood that very well. He understood that very well about America. And he understood why the French had to think very hard about this and why they failed always to do this.
And well, with that, like with him trying to, when he comes back, he writes Democracy in America, that first volume, as you note in your book. I mean, that was very well accepted, very well praised by, you know, a ton of people in France, also in America, and in Britain. In particular, his relationship with John Stuart Mill. You know, you talk a lot about that. But was it, with the reception of the book, was there a, man, that's a really good book, but the reception of instituting that in France, how difficult was that for Alexis to persuade the French to adopt?
Tocqueville's ambition was to be a politician. More important to be a politician than to be a writer. The legal age to run for election was 30, and it was just about 9 months after he published the first volume of Democracy in America, and he couldn't wait to get into the fray. He actually, there was really no opportunity to be elected until 1837. He failed in 1837 to be elected, was finally elected in 1839, and then remained in the chamber pretty much until the Napoleonic Empire, when he resigned because he didn't want to serve a despot. So he fought all his life for major reforms, including, as I mentioned already, the abolition of slavery, the rehabilitation of criminals as a sort of a follow-up on this prison reform report, the rehabilitation of prisoners after they leave prison. He fought very hard for the freedom of teaching, that is, for some kind of reconciliation in France between church and state. That is their existing coexistence. And he was in very much impressed by the American model of separation of church and state. Now, this is one of the, this leads me, this way I can sort of loop as to one of the things he missed in America. Tocqueville was, if you allow me a little storytelling here. Tocqueville was a pretty daring teenager. He was extremely smart and a great student, but also very daring and doing crazy things like many of us do in our teenage years. But among the crises of his teenage years was the loss of Christian faith. He locked himself up in his father's library when his father was away on various assignments, and read 18th century philosophy and lost his faith. And he always felt that religious doubt was the most miserable thing he had ever felt, but he couldn't get rid of it. So all his life, he worked very hard to recover his faith. And when he was in America, 25 years old, young man, he made a point of talking to Catholic priests. He wanted to write to his mother that he was seeing priests and that he was attending mass. And he did all of that. But the upshot of that is that he mostly talked to Catholic priests. He really talked very little to Protestant ministers, except when they were chaplains in penitentiaries. So he talked to chaplains in penitentiaries, and he talked to Unitarians in Boston. But he thought, rightly so, that Unitarianism pushed to the extreme would eventually be natural religion. But one thing that Tocqueville missed completely, to my great surprise, was the influence of evangelical religion in this country. He missed it entirely. And he traveled through the upstate New York at the time of the Second Great Awakening. Nobody ever talked to him about the Second Great Awakening, and he didn't pick it up either. And he traveled along the Mohawk Valley and down the Erie Canal. It's just absolutely amazing. And yet he wrote some brilliant pages on the significance of religion in America and how Americans should reconcile the spirit of religion and the spirit of liberty. So, you know, that I'm saying this because even though he made some extremely keen observations, one of the most profound things he did were not in sync. One of the most profound things he wrote were not in sync with his observations. And you have to think that when you write, you know, you will create a world, not all of which is connected to reality as you saw it, but the power of intelligence pushed him to the right judgment. There's something really interesting here. That's one of the things I try to do in my book, is to explain how he worked and how he came to some really important conclusions. This is why I insisted on what he missed.
Well, speaking of conclusions and almost his evolvement in some of his early thinking to his later thinking, this was something that I found really fascinating in your book, was his evolving view of the welfare system. And I found it fascinating because it reminds me of the current view that America has between liberals and conservatives. How did Tocqueville feel about welfare, and how did his views on welfare evolve?
I'm glad you're asking this question. I'm really glad you're asking this question because initially, you know, initially Tocqueville has a very negative view of welfare. He won't, shortly after writing the first, first of all, he didn't experience, didn't experience poverty in America. Yes, he saw Native Americans being poor and living on handouts in upstate New York. He watched some early episodes of the Trail of Tears. He realized the plights of African Americans and wrote quite movingly about it, actually, in the last volume of Democracy, the last chapter of Democracy in America. But poverty was not a feature of American life that he studied or saw much of at all. And even in the prison report, he never tried to establish a relationship between poverty and crime. That's not an issue that he wrote about in the prison report. It was mostly about how prisons were organized and lately what were the hopes for rehabilitation of criminals. Rehabilitation was a big issue that he was involved with. Okay, what is the best way to obtain rehabilitation? Would it be total isolation, you know, cellular isolation of the Pennsylvania system, solitary confinement, or would it be a partial confinement only at night? What would be the role of religion in this? I mean, so poverty was never really part of it. Now, shortly after publishing Democracy in America, a small scholarly society near his chateau in Normandy, the family estate, asked him to write an essay on pauperism. And he read a little bit around and he kind of concluded that almsgiving, basically charity, only generated poverty. That, in other words, it's pretty much an anti-welfare tract. American conservatives have republished it over the years and claimed to have ruined their camp. Several years after he published his brief 20-page little essay, he disavowed it. I mean, some people asked him for it. They said, you know, don't even pay attention to it. I was wrong. But the fact is that his real first encounter with poverty was during a trip to England in between the two democracies. That is, he published the first volume in 1835, the second volume in 1840. He made a long trip to England during this period and visited industrial England, visited Manchester, visited the industrial towns, the cotton mills of England. He didn't know them as well as Friedrich Engels, of course, who knew every alley in Manchester, but he saw enough of it to be completely horrified and wrote quite eloquently about this. And this is from England, from his trip to England, that he derived this famous theory of the threat of an industrial aristocracy in the second volume of Democracy in America. So in writing about the threat of an industrial democracy in Democracy in America, Volume 2, he was not foreseeing or predicting the Gilded Age. He was describing the England he had seen a couple of years earlier, but didn't tell you that. He just labeled it Democracy in America and said, if you think of democracy in the future, well, there's this threat. When he was in America and he was in Boston, he didn't visit the textile mills in Lowell. bypassed whatever, even though the textile mills in Lowell were nothing like Manchester. They were fairly prosperous. They were farmers' daughters working there and whatnot. And also Tocqueville discovered rural poverty by, you know, going from England to Ireland and then touring Ireland right after that. So, and in the 1840s, became really interested in socialist theories, even though he never engaged socialists directly, a few of them by chance and only superficially, but socialists read him. Now, for example, Louis Blanc was one of the great socialist theorists of the 19th century, with his theories about you know, reorganizing work and the world of work, but you know, one of the pioneers in thinking about the proper organization of work in the 19th century. He was also a member of the French Chamber. He wrote a rave review of Democracy in America when it came out. Tocqueville never really engaged him because Louis Blanc believed that the revolutionary terror was unavoidable, that the aristocracy was trying to destroy from being immigrants from France, was trying to destroy the French Revolution. They needed to be stopped. So Tocqueville was not going to engage with people like that. He was too loyal to his family and friends to even think of engaging in a conversation with them. Now, 1848 and the fierce battle of June, February 1st, but then especially June 1848, turned Tocqueville really strongly against the socialists. He said, you know, you guys are everything but Democrats. And as French socialists who were kicked out of the country during the Second Empire were trying to reestablish themselves in America, Tocqueville actually told them, don't even go there because nobody's going to pay attention to them, even though he conveniently ignored that there were a lot of communal movements in the 1840s in this country. Okay, here you go.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because what I mean, that leaned right into my next question on his view of socialism. Is that was my next question. So, last question, and it may be my last question, it may not be my last question, but this Tocqueville's theories or his theory on revolutions, like, struck me. I sat there for a little while just thinking about this, and I pull a quote from your book. This you're quoting him in his book, Ancient Regime and the French Revolution, when he writes, "It is not always going from bad to worse that leads to revolution. What happens most often is that a people that put up with the most oppressive laws without complaint, as if they do not feel them, rejects those laws violently when the burden is alleviated." So how did he come to that conclusion? And does that theory ring true to you?
Well, it is one of the most famous, of course. I'm glad you're going there because, of course, in this country, let me just take a sip of water here.
Go for it.
In this country, few people have read the book on the old regime, the Ancien Régime and the French Revolution, which was Tocqueville's last book. He resigned his, he had been briefly foreign minister in 1849, Minister of Foreign Affairs. But he resigned his position in the chamber after the coup, Napoleon III, Louis Napoleon's coup, a year before Napoleon Louis Napoleon became Napoleon III by declaring himself emperor again. And Tocqueville, who had poor health and was suffering from a pulmonary disease, really wanted to write a book to go back to the initial conversation we had on how the first emperor had managed to reestablish despotism on the ashes of the French Revolution, and how this revolution fought in the name of liberty ended up in despotism. So Tocqueville really wanted to write a book about this. And as often happened among historians, and it's happened to me many times in my life of writing books, you begin with a topic, and then you begin searching about the origins of this and the beginning of that. And as Tocqueville was writing about how Napoleon came to power, and the 18th Brumaire, he kept also looking at different aspects of the revolution and went further and further back. And what was supposed to be a brief introduction to his book on the coming of Napoleon became a full book on the old regime and the French Revolution. Now, he was extremely interested in, he realized that there were a lot of reforms in the 18th century, that in effect, the privileges, so-called privileges, that were abolished formally on August the 4th, 1789, by the National Assembly at the beginning of the French Revolution. So just a few short weeks after the storming of the Bastille, it was ratifying in paper what had happened long before. That is to say that it had been for a long time that feudal lords were no longer exacting heavy taxes on peasants, that the French peasantry had acquired land, the king no longer had complete absolute power. There were provincial assemblies that were pulling their weight. Of course, there was much, much still a great deal of abuses of power, but nonetheless, the situation at the time the revolution erupted was not nearly as severe as it had been 50, 60, 80 years before. Now, in order to test this, Tocqueville learned German, spent 3 hours a day for a year to master German, and decided to go to Germany and to study German history, and went to Germany spent several months there, studied in the archives, talked to people specialized in the history of law, historians in various places, and well-informed people, and concluded that late 18th century German peasants were not very different than 16th century German peasants. That basically all feudal rights were still pretty much the same. And except for some of the Rhenan provinces along the Rhine, in a few borderland sections, actually bordering with France. And so he got what he came to find. And because there hadn't been any trace of any revolutionary movement in Germany. So again, Tocqueville's way of thinking was often by comparison. So this there was a lot of comparison between France and America, and England being the natural tertium quid of that comparison for writing democracy in America. And in looking at America, he was looking, say, at the future of France. But in looking at Germany, he was looking at the past and concluded, hey, these are two different paths. In France, there was basically a liberalizing movement and a revolution. In Germany, there was no such liberalizing movement and no revolution. That's how it came to be.
Yeah, it's his theory on that. I mean, he's talking in the mid-1800s, and it reminds me of sort of what took place in the Russian Revolution, where you have the Tsar sort of, you know, things are getting incrementally better, and then all of a sudden it's not enough. As he wrote in his book, they violently rejected all of it. This is going to be my official last question. Alexis de Tocqueville, the French Enlightenment thinkers obviously came before him. When it comes to the influence on France, how does Alexis de Tocqueville compare to the French Enlightenment thinkers?
Well, I'm going to answer on two levels here. Tocqueville was a man of one idea. The idea I began with, that is to say, equality, properly understood, generates liberty. And in effect, in the ideal world, equality and liberty are the same thing. Because if you everybody is equal, you are completely free. And if you're completely free, you are everybody is equal. So in an ideal world, these two qualities touch and join. That was his expression, touch and join. In the real world, unfortunately, too many people prefer equality and are willing to give up their political liberty to keep it, hence their submission to some kind of despotic regime. And Tocqueville's lifelong work was to put an end to that. Now, Tocqueville, as I also mentioned early on, decided that being an intellectual was not enough, and he wanted to be a politician, and he wanted to inform political theory with practical politics and vice versa. He thought he had it in him to create an original fusion between the two. 18th century philosophers are not interested, and Tocqueville actually pointed that out time and again, in playing a political role directly. They were interested in the work of reform. They created huge intellectual systems that were hugely influential, but had no connection with actual practical politics. Tocqueville actually, it was kind of a mystery to Tocqueville. Actually, he devoted a whole chapter of his book on the Ancien Régime on that topic. How is it possible that people who had absolutely no understanding of practical politics could be so politically influential? But on the other hand, they created a road to freedom that didn't exist before, and it took a life of its own.
Yeah, I was looking to see if I could find the notes that I had written down on that very idea that you were talking about, which was the premise of Tocqueville's idea of equality and liberty being the same thing, and how you mentioned, because I want to say it was like in page like 180, 188, somewhere in there, but it's in there, and it's very, very well thought out, is people's idea of equality does not equate to liberty. It is bringing everybody onto the same level, when in fact it is, it's all about freedom. It's all about liberty. If you're free, absolutely, then you are equal. And that's it. And I've always, viewed it as well is equality as far as equality in the eyes of the law. Like, we all are equal in the eyes of the law. We are able to, it does not matter your stature, your political affiliation, your socioeconomic, you know, stature, anything like that. You're equal in the eyes of the law, which also ties right back into liberty and freedom. Yeah, it's fantastic. I Alexis de Tocqueville, I don't think is overlooked in America. I think he is very well embraced here in America. And I think you and your work, you've done so much on the subject of Tocqueville to keep him in the forefront, or to keep him at least in front of mind. Yes, and I think it's incredibly necessary. This biography that you wrote, I mean, I really enjoyed it, and I think what I think a lot of people, whether they are interested in history or they're interested in politics or they're politicians right now, I think that they should read this book and understand that whether you are young or old, your mindset, much like Alexis de Tocqueville, as we discussed, can evolve. You can stand strong on something that you feel is very right, and a few years later or a decade or two later, you realize that, no, you're not correct. You're wrong, or at least you're somewhat wrong, and you need to evolve in your opinions. I think that's one of the great takeaways from your book.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, I hope, like I say, I hope even modern day politicians from every side of the aisle, I hope that they would take the time to read the book and understand that there's nothing wrong with, you know, having a viewpoint and then realizing, okay, I was wrong, and changing. It's not hypocrisy. It's just the evolution of political theory or evolution of thought.
Yeah, and greater level of understanding and deepening of thoughts. Yes, of course.
So, Dr. Zunz, hey, this was fantastic. So much information. Like I said, I promised you I was going to have a lot of questions. And thank you for answering and taking your time to answer all of those. I greatly appreciate it.
Well, I'm delighted to have been here. Thank you, Dustin.
That was a really fascinating and enlightening conversation with Dr. Zunz. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you learned a lot. I know I did, because honestly, in between, Dr. Zunz and I spoke for about another 30 minutes on some other questions that I had. Just a wealth of knowledge and information. So, ladies and gentlemen, obviously, this book is fantastic. And speaking of this book, book and movie recommendation. So this book is my recommendation. Obviously, The Man Who Understood Democracy, The Life of Alexis de Tocqueville. So much information about the times in which he lived and what he strived towards. I really think, even from my perspective, when I was reading it, like, there were ideas sort of implanted in my head that had never been there before. And I think that is one of the benefits of reading this book, is that you will start looking at political philosophies in ways that you hadn't before, or ideas regarding the French Revolution and regarding America as well, in ways that you hadn't. So that is my book recommendation. It is available now. Also, you can go on the Epoch Times, search for me, and you can find my review on the book. Now, speaking of France, I'm going to go ahead and do my movie recommendation, Léon the Professional. If you've never seen that movie, super cool. One of my favorite actors, Jean Reno. I think that's maybe how you say it, or it's Jean Reno, if you want to go straight up Southern Texas. I am in Texas, so if you want to go Southern states, Jean Reno. So he's in the movie. Natalie Portman and Gary Oldman's in the movie. A really, really cool cult classic that I think you'll really enjoy, especially if you like action films. So ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't yet, check us out on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Follow us all there. Subscribe. And if you haven't yet, please subscribe to our podcast, wherever you're listening, Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, Google. You can check out all those places. If you're able to leave a rating and review, it would be a great help to us. If you did, we thank you very much. And that is it for the show. Alan is not there. It's just me. And Madison is dead asleep on the floor. I will talk to you later.